Okay, yes. Yes, yes. Now, is this one, can people in the back hear me? Okay, so my name is Kunxin Luo, and I'm going to be the last instructor of MCB 130. So it's only 5 weeks before the final, and I'm your last barrier. Before we start the lecture, let me just go through some of the logistics. My office hour, I have 2 office hours per week. The first one is Wednesday at 12 noon to 1 o'clock, and the second one is Friday from 12 to 1. And my office is at 41 Kaohsiung, and that's on the ground level. So if you enter on the street level, you need to go down and then make a right turn. It's a round building, so you will come up to 41 eventually. The quiz is going to be on Friday, April 24th. And I think that date is on your syllabus, is that right? Please check. It's Friday, April 24th. It's exactly in the middle of the 5-week lecture. So same format as you had before. I think it was a 10 minutes quiz, 25 points, is that right? Okay. Is it 25 points? 10 points? 10 minutes, 10 points? Okay, sorry. Whatever you know is correct, okay? I don't remember the details. And so I'm going to take a different format from Professor Sheckman and Professor Drubin. I'm going to use PowerPoint all the time because my handwriting is terrible and nobody's going to be able to read it. Before each lecture, I'm actually going to upload all my PowerPoint slides onto the B-Space course website, and I see many of you have it. So let me do a survey. So what I did yesterday was to put it up in 3 formats. One is 2 slides per page, and the other one is 3 slides per page, and the 6 slides per page. I'd like to know which format you prefer the best. Can I have a show of hands? How many of you like 2 slides per page? Okay, how many of you like 3 slides per page? And what about 6? Why don't we just cover every option as possible? It looked like a, you know, maybe I would just stick to what I did yesterday, 2, 3, and 6, and each of you pick whatever you like. How's that? So now I know many people, at least that's what happened in the past. They don't like PowerPoint format because they worry there are just too many things that I need to go through. So I want to assure you that the amount of material I go through is actually exactly the same as what the other professors did when they were doing chalk. Actually, my outline of the course exactly the same as this course 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago where the professor was doing the chalk talk. I actually deleted some of the materials because it's too much. All right, so it's actually not more. So what I want you to do is, because you have exactly the slide that I'm going to show you, it means that you don't really need to worry about copy everything down in the lectures. And what I want you to do is to sit back and listen, not relax, but listen. And don't get too comfortable. Sit back and listen and think at the same time. Instead of copying everything down, now you get time to think. And there are 2 things that I want you to think a lot during the process. One is why. Ask 2 questions. One is why, and the other is how. Why are things happening the way it happens, and how things happen? And these are the fundamental important things underlying signal transduction, which is what we're trying to cover in the next 5 weeks, is cell-cell communication, cell signaling. And this cell signaling part is actually very logical. There are a lot of logical connections and links between each steps, and I want you to understand the links, the logics between the upstream steps and downstream steps, and why are things happening. Now, there are some memorizations. You know, the protein names, there's nothing you can do but to memorize it. I'll try to add a story or two for you to help you memorize it if if there are stories, but not every protein are named based on a story. And unfortunately, you just have to remember them. It's the same as you remember your friend's name. Why is your friend named Jennifer or Robert? Their parents give their names. You don't have any choice. You memorize that. Same thing for the protein names here. You memorize that. But doesn't mean that you have to memorize all the pathways and everything. The key is conceptual understanding. Okay, I want to emphasize conceptual understanding, that you know the names, but the connection between the names and how one step proceeds to the next step, how the signal get relayed from one step to the second, how it goes from the plasma membrane to the nucleus. I want you to understand the logic there and not just purely simply memorization. Okay. The other thing I like to encourage you to do is to interrupt me and ask questions when you have them. And don't think that you might ask a stupid question. There is no such thing as a stupid question. If you ask them, they're not stupid. And by asking questions, you might be doing everybody else a favor, because a lot of people might have the exactly same question, but they're afraid to ask, and or they may not think of it clear enough to ask. So if you ask the question, everybody will listen and thank you. And also there's some difficult parts that sometimes when I get excited, I tend to go a little bit too fast. So when you ask a question, you slow me down and you're doing everybody a favor. Okay, are there any questions? Okay, so the major topic that we're going to cover is cell communication and cell signaling. Now, we all know that we are human beings and we exist in a community. We do not exist in isolation. And communication is the most important thing to maintain order and function of our community in our society. And communication, of course, can take in different forms. You can talk to each other in an amicable manner, or debate on TV, or solving the questions through diplomatic channels, or fight on the battlefield. Either way, it's communication. Whether the way you like it or not, it's communication. And that's necessary. And it's the same thing for ourselves, the same thing for all the organisms, including very simple organisms such as single cell eukaryotic microorganisms. Things like yeast, slime mold, or insects, they communicate a lot. And one prime example is that they use pheromones. They produce pheromones and use pheromones to coordinate mating. And of course, our humans for years has been trying to mimic that action by using colognes. And it doesn't work nearly as well. In bacteria, single cell bacteria, they also communicate. And there's a phenomenon called quorum sensing. And if you watch PBS, you might actually see the program describing the work of Professor Boni, what's her last name? Boni Basler, thank you, at Princeton University, where she studies this phenomenon in bacteria called quorum sensing. And this is a phenomenon that refers to the ability of bacteria to stay put until they accumulate to a certain density, then they start to turn on, change their behaviors. For example, in your body, we also have this type of pathogenic bacteria that they actually stay put. They do not cause any problems when the numbers are low. However, when they accumulate to a certain high number, then they start to become very aggressive and start to challenge your immune system to cause disease. So in these bacteria, they actually produce chemicals to sense the density of their community. And when the density is low, they tell them not to do anything. And when the density is high, they secrete certain chemicals to tell each other that our density is very high and their enemy's density is certain level, so they can evaluate the situation and decide what to do. So that's actually very important. Now, in higher mammalian cells, because we're more complex, we often use more than one way to communicate, but certainly communication is very important. For example, in mouse and in human, when we are hungry, we got to go eat. And when you've had enough, then the hypothalamus region of our brain would produce a hormone to tell us I'm full and stop eating. So normally what happens is by maintaining the right communication channel, by keeping that communication channel intact, you get a normal mouse with a balanced weight. Now what happens is if that communication channel is disrupted, either through deletion of a critical gene, as in the case in the mouse, or by repetitively going to an all-you-can-eat buffet and eat like crazy to get your money's worth, then you turn into this mouse into a big monster, and a beast mouse. So that's what happens when you disrupt the proper signal transduction pathway. And it's a very important process, obviously. When we come down to the cellular level, the individual cells in our body also needs to communicate. And I'm going to show you a little movie to show that the cells actually can sense the chemical signals. And the cell that we're going to look, this is the look at, this is the cell, this is a human neutrophil. This is the type of immune system cells that when you have a viral infection, then there's a local inflammation and all these reactions going on. Neutrophil then undergo this process called chemotaxis, that they react to a certain chemicals, they move to the site of the infection and help to mount an immune response to the infection. So what you're seeing here is a pipette tip, that at the tip, there are some chemical molecules in here, and you see the neutrophil will move with the pipette. When you move the pipette, it changed the direction of moving. Poor thing, keep chasing. Okay, so that shows that the individual cell actually react to signal transduction. So now what are the major steps in signal transduction? So most of the times, the signals that's produced is actually synthesized at a different site from where it actually acts on. For example, insulin is produced in the pancreatic beta cells and then gets secreted into the bloodstreams. And the action site is actually on the liver cells. So hormone can go from one site to the other. Okay, epinephrine, another hormone, is usually produced by the adrenal gland and then go to act on different part of the body, in muscle cells and in other cells. So the synthesis of the signaling molecules usually happen in one site where the molecules are synthesized. And many times these molecules are not being released immediately into the bloodstream. Instead, they're being stored in a vesicle under the plasma membrane. The signal, the hormones that's produced by the hypothalamus region of the brain many times are stored in these vesicles inside the cells. And you need a special signal to trigger the release of these molecules. And those signals that trigger release of these vesicles usually involves changes in the local calcium concentration. And when that happens, then these vesicles could possibly fuse with the plasma membrane, and then through the process called exocytosis, then these molecules get secreted out of the cells. I'm sure you, Professor Shechtman has covered this part, right? So try to remember that part. So the first step is to synthesize a signaling molecule. And we are going to talk about a little bit later, the signaling molecules can take in on the different forms. It can be proteins, it can be amino acid, it can even be gas. So one cell produces these signal molecules, and then the second step is the release of the signaling molecules. And each of these steps are regulated or triggered by a special signal. And then the third step is the transport of the signaling molecule to the target cells. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. The distance of transport can vary quite a lot. In the adrenal gland that produces epinephrine, the distance it travels actually quite far away. Insulin that's being produced and then where it acts on can be quite far away. But other signals, like neurotransmitters, from the neuron to the muscle cells, it's actually very close to each other. And in the case of immune cells, it has to be a cell-cell contact. So this distance can vary quite a lot. And therefore, the time it takes for a certain signal to really produce a response varies quite a lot. Obviously, you can tell these two cells are really close by, you have almost instant responses, where if these two are really far away, it might take minutes for it to happen. So when we were talking about time scale, when the cells are concerned, we're not talking about the normal life time scale. You know, a couple seconds for you is really short. And when we talk about long time, we talk about days or months. In the cells, when we talk about fast stuff, for example, a neurotransmitter can travel in the axon. Each second, it can travel 100 meters. So we're talking about different time scales. Millisecond is what we're talking about fast. And minute is slow, okay, when it comes to the cell contact. Okay, so these are the three different steps. And then the next step will be when the signal reaches the target cells, many times the signals cannot get into the cells because a lot of these signaling molecules are water-soluble molecules, where our cell membrane are lipid bilayers. They do not permit the hydrophilic molecules to randomly go inside. So they need to be helped with another molecule that get the signal inside without themselves all the time being going inside. Many signaling molecules get internalized, but not all of them. Okay. Now, some signaling molecules, such as steroid hormones, they actually can diffuse through the plasma membrane. So there are different ways of doing it. What it shows on this slide is only one way of receptor action, and we're going to talk slightly later that there's another type of receptor. It's not cell surface receptor, but intracellular receptors. In those cases, the ligand can actually go into the cells and bind to the receptor that stays inside the cells. Some of those receptors are cytoplasmic, and others are actually nuclear. So what's showing here is the case of majority of the receptors are cell surface receptors because they help these signaling molecules to overcome this really big physical barrier. Okay, so the step four is binding of a ligand to a specific receptor, and that usually causes a conformational change in the receptor itself, which usually alter its enzymatic activities or alter its ability to interact with downstream molecules. And through these type of alterations, then you can transmit the signals downstream. And we're saying that, talking about this, describing it as an activation of intracellular signal pathways by the receptors. And that's done through a protein conformational change and alteration in its enzymatic activity. Now, the signal transduction pathways can be many steps. Some pathways are very short, involve one or two two proteins. Other pathways can go on 10 different steps in order to reach a certain response. And the ultimate response is the cells can modify metabolism, proliferation status, function, or movement. And then also, that's what we call the specific changes in cellular process, or causes the activation of feedback regulation. And when we talk about feedbacks, we can talk about two types. There's positive feedbacks. A certain signal induces more of that signal to be produced, or it can be negative feedback regulation to turn the whole thing off. Because whenever you have a signal that goes on, you have to find a way to shut it down. Otherwise, if you have a growth signal to the cells, keep growing, if you don't have a way to shut it down, we get cancer, right? So everything in our body has to work in a perfect circle. You have to have a way to turn it on, you have to have the way to turn it off. So when we talk about the signal pathway, every step, you should think about what are the ways to turn it off. Everything goes between an active state and inactive state. If you have a molecule that only stays in the active state and you cannot turn it off, what does the cell do? Get rid of the protein. So you have to have a way to turn off every step. And that's why the whole communication network is so complicated. Not only you have this molecule that functions in a certain way, you have to have millions of other ways to turn it on, turn it off, keep it in a certain state to regulate it. And every one of those needs to be turn it on, turn it off, regulate it. So it mushrooms into a very complex network. And I'm pretty sure by the end of the 5 weeks, you get totally fed up with these networks. But just remember, what I'm teaching you is less than 1% of what we know. And what we know is probably less than 10% of what's really going on in our body. Okay? So don't hate this part. It's really going on inside you all the time. And right, so the final step to simplify the manner is the deactivation of the receptor. But in reality, receptor is not the only one that get deactivated. Many things, every step in the inside of the pathway get deactivated. But that's pretty much the overall view of what are the general steps of signal transduction. And in this course, I'm not going to talk too much about step 1, 2, and 3. Protein synthesis is something that you covered in 100 or 102. Secretion of the molecules, Randy already covered that, and transport is depend on individual steps, and that's not signaling. So what we're going to, I'm going to cover in this course is pretty much these steps, starting from binding to the receptors to mostly intracellular pathways. This is the part that shows the most complexity. So I'm just going, giving you an overview. And when we go into a lot of details later on, please remember the big picture from the very beginning. So everything I talk about today is the general summary of what's going on. And some of them may sound obvious to you, some of them may sound weird. It's okay if you don't get everything today, because you're going to have a lot of specific examples throughout the course. At the end of it, please remember to come back to look at what we covered in today's lecture, the lecture one, and to be able to simplify it manner a little bit, and that will help you to remember things. Removal of the signaling molecule. So these are the major component of the signal transduction pathway. At the beginning of the pathway is this extracellular signal molecules. These molecules can be can come through the bloodstream, can come directly by the cell produced next door. So these molecules are generally called ligand. Okay, ligand, we call, you'll hear me using this word at the same time as I use specific names. Some of the ligand are growth factors. For example, I'll say epidermal growth factors or EGF. Sometimes I say EGF binding, sometimes I say ligand binding. I'm talking about the same thing. Ligand is a the general name for all the ligand, for all the molecules that bind to the receptors. When I don't know the specific identity, or when I don't feel like referring to the identity, I can use the word ligand, but it's pretty much the same thing. Ligand is a molecule that binds to the receptor. Receptor is a molecule in the cells. As I said, it can be on the cell surface or can be inside the cells. And majority of them are on the cell surface. Is this molecule that specifically binds to the ligand? And we're going to talk about what specific means, because there's always non-specific binding. It's like you walk on the street on a windy day, the leaves will stick on your shirt for a few minutes. That's not specific binding. Your shirt is not the receptor for the leaves, right? And same thing happens in the cells. When you have all these bloodstream go through, you get tons of signaling molecules. Some of them non-specific stick to a cell surface, to this protein or that protein for a very short period of time, they fall off. And these things happen all the time. It's very dynamic. Those are not receptors. Receptors bind to ligand very specifically and at very high affinity, okay? And then the receptor receives that and then turn on the intracellular pathway. And most of these pathway members are proteins. They can be lipid molecules, they can be other small molecules, but most of them are proteins. And through this stepwise changes, the signals get transmitted from the cell membrane to the nucleus, where the decision making happens in the cells. So these molecules each undergo either a conformational change or being modified in certain way covalently that change their activities, and that's how the signal gets transmitted downstream. And eventually it hit on the effector proteins, which directly changes cell metabolism or change the gene regulatory mechanisms. These are transcription factors that can activate expression a set of genes. They can change cytoskeletal proteins so that a cell overall will change shape or change its morphology or change the movement ability. So these are the simplified component of these pathways. In terms of ligand, this is the molecule that's produced by the signaling molecule that's produced by the cells. As I said, it can be proteins, a lot of them are proteins, but they can be smaller peptides. A lot of the neurotransmitters are small peptides. They can be amino acid derivatives. It can be hydrophobic molecules, steroid hormones, estrogens, prolactin, and a lot of these retinoic acid, and these molecules can all be signal molecules. Even gas, nitric oxide, that's produced by the cells, they can all act on the cells to trigger a whole series of events that's happening. There are three main categories in terms of their permeability in the cells. So some of them are small lipophilic molecules. Lipophilic meaning they like lipid, they're hydrophobic in a way. These molecules can interact directly with the lipid bilayer, the phospholipid on the cell membrane, which allow them to diffuse across the plasma membrane. So these are the type of ligand that actually bind to their receptors inside the cells. Their receptors are not on the cell surface because you don't need to. They can get in the cells pretty easily. Prime examples are the families of steroid hormones, cortisones, estrogens, retinoic acid. These are old molecules that can actually get into the cells. Okay. There are also water-soluble molecules, which is the case for all the proteins, amino acids. These are all peptides. These are all water-soluble hydrophilic molecules. They, of course, cannot pass through the plasma membrane, and therefore they need the help of cell surface receptors to get through. And the examples are growth factors, and we're going to talk a lot of them about this category of molecules. And then you have these special type of lipophilic molecules that they like lipid, but the cell membrane type of lipid is not their type of lipid, and therefore they still cannot get into the cells, even though they like lipid, they're a different type. So they need the cell surface receptors to help them to send the signals inside. This lipophilic molecule cannot go through the plasma membrane. So it's not like that you have lipophilic molecules you can go through membrane. It's not true. Only some of them can get through. An example is a prostaglandin, which actually regulates cell proliferation, and those molecules need the cell surface receptors. So these categories are pretty artificial. We classify them so that we can actually understand their function better. Now, the receptors, of course, are the molecules in the target cells that bind to the ligand with high affinity and great specificity. So these are the two really important points about the receptor. High affinity, we need high affinity because the ligand concentration in the bloodstream is usually very small. We're talking about in the range of 10 to the minus 8 molar. Okay, so it's a very low concentration ligand. By the time, so your body actually don't want to produce too much of these ligands to flood the system. Insulin is one of the most abundant signaling molecules in the bloodstream, and it's really not very high concentration. Think about all the neuropeptide that your brain produce. It's actually happening at a very low concentration. Once you get the signal, they disappear. And you don't want them to flood your system because you cannot turn it off easily. Life changes really fast. In a split second, things can happen. Your body wants to be able to respond to that and then ready to respond to the next signal. So ligand always are present at very low concentration. So unless the receptor can bind to ligand at very high affinity, you cannot bind very stably, right? So you need to have a high affinity binding so that the ligand stay on the receptor for a certain duration in order to have time for the signal to go downstream. If the affinity is too low, you bind, you go away, nothing can happen. There's not enough time. Great specificity, I don't need to say too much about it. If insulin can bind to every type of cells, it creates havoc. You need to bind a certain ligand to bind to the specific target cells and only create a response in those cells, not create response everywhere else. So these are two very important criteria. As I said, most of the receptors in the cells are cell surface receptors. They bind to the ligand and transmit the signals inside. Now, if you look at these receptors, it has to have three parts, three components. And of course, it's one protein, just in different conformations. It's not three proteins glued together. It's actually one protein. On the outside, it has to have an extracellular domain that functions to bind to ligand. And this is the part that creates the affinity, high affinity, and specificity. It recognizes the ligand, the shape. Certain pocket has to be fitting really well. And once it binds really well. Okay, so the extracellular has to have a ligand binding domain. And then because this is the cell surface molecule, you need to have a segment of the protein that anchor it on the cell membrane. So we call it a transmembrane domain, which is this little part, which keep the molecule standing up there stably, so it anchors the receptor. And then, of course, you need to, in order to send the signal inside, you need to have a cytoplasmic domain that initiate signaling. So what usually happens is that the ligand binds to the extracellular domain, and that causes a conformational change in the transmembrane domain, and that change also get transmitted into the cytoplasmic domain. So you have a change in conformation that result in either alteration of the enzymatic activity of the receptor, if it's a kinase, for example, or alter its ability to interact with other molecules. For example, you have a conformational change. You expose a domain that used not to be there. And so that's usually what happens. So cytoplasmic domain directly contact molecules inside and send the signals into the cells. And as I said, there is another type of receptors, like the receptors that bind to sterile hormone family of proteins. These sterile hormones can directly diffuse into the cells. And inside the cells, they bind to their receptors. Now, these receptors can be in the cytosol or can be in the nucleus, depending on the specific molecules. For example, estrogen receptors usually in the cytosol without the ligand. And when you bind to ligand, the whole thing change conformation and move into the nucleus. But for other molecules like retinoic acid, its receptors are already inside the nucleus. So retinoic acid not only goes through the cell membrane, it also goes through the nuclear membrane to bind to its receptor inside. In both situations, without ligand binding, the receptors are there, but it's in the inactive conformation. And when your ligand binds to the receptors, it changes the conformation so that the receptors can now go into the nucleus and then direct gene expression programs. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that next lecture. But that's the whole idea, is that the protein, the receptor has to change conformation when the ligand binds, and that changes its enzymatic activity or changes ability, for example, to bind to DNA and allow them to regulate transcription. So these are the two main categories of receptors. And we are actually going to spend essentially all the time in the course on this category of receptors and the signaling pathways they activate. Now, when we say the signal transduction happens over a long distance, the distance can vary quite a lot. And based on that distance, we can categorize the signaling into different groups. For example, in the endocrine signaling, the organ that produces the signaling molecule is very far away from the target of these hormones. So the hormones are being produced at one side of the body, and they need to be transported over a long distance to the distant target cells. And examples here, of course, are insulin, for example, epinephrine, or these adrenal gland hormones. Some of the neuropeptides that's produced by the hypothalamus that tell you that you're full, these are the hormones that all function in such a way. So you can imagine that in this type of signaling, it will take a little while for target cells to start responding to your hormones. Okay? And these hormones must also be quite stable in the bloodstream, that they cannot be killed. If the minute they enter bloodstream, they get killed, they will never be able to get to the distant target cells. So this type of hormones are usually pretty stable in the bloodstream. They have a relatively long half-life, and they can wait until they get to the target cells for things to happen. Now, this thing doesn't take days. It takes minutes. You know, think about when you're running into a crisis, when your adrenal gland starts to secrete your emergency hormone. It doesn't take your days to act. So when I say it takes a long time, we're talking about minute, 1 minute or 2 minutes. That's a long time in terms of cells. Okay. So that's one type. Relatively short than that, we call the paracrine signaling, meaning the molecules in the neighborhood of the target cells produce the hormones, secrete it out, and then get taken up by adjacent target cells. The two cells are not too far away. That's why it's called paracrine. Now, when it's not too far away, you have to control essentially the half-life of these molecules. The ligand cannot diffuse for too long. The reason that they cannot diffuse for too long is usually you have neighboring cells that take them up and start responding. Or these molecules are not very stable. They get degraded over a long time, and therefore they can only have enough time to act on neighboring cells. When they try to go further away, the enzymes can degrade them. They get immobilized by other molecules in the extracellular matrix. Remember, our tissue is not a clean cell, clean place where the cell exists in isolation. The cells are connected by a network of extracellular matrix. And there are many proteins in this extracellular matrix, such as heparin proteoglycans. These are molecules that have long sugar chains. They take up a lot of these hormones and immobilize them so that they cannot go very far away. So these are short distance acting molecules. The advantage of this over the long distance ones is that you don't need to produce a lot. You just need to produce a little bit, and your neighboring cells will be able to act on it. And it can be quite specific. Now, the ones that go over long distance, you have to produce quite a lot of it in order for it to survive the whole transport process. And that's why insulin is a very abundant molecule in the cells, because they need to travel to the other organs. But a lot of these short-distance interactions happen at very low concentration of ligand. So it doesn't cost you too much energy to make a lot of these ligand, and the target cells can respond. Now, an extreme case of paracrine signaling is that the molecules that produce, the cells that produce this ligand is the same cells that take it up. So we call it autocrine signaling, meaning that the cells produce these signaling molecules, ligand, they secrete them, and the same cell possess receptor to take them up. So these molecules really cannot go very far, get taken up by itself. This is the type of signaling that happens a lot in cancer cells. And that's why cancer cells are very independent. They don't need the hormones coming from the bloodstream or from neighboring cells to keep growing. They can produce their own growth factors, then they can benefit directly from their own production and keep growing out of control, because there's no more mechanism to keep the ligand away. Okay, so this is called autocrine signaling. And finally, when the distance gets really close, you have to have two cells contact each other. Now, this is contact dependent. In this mode of action, the ligand itself is a cell membrane protein. The ligand never gets secreted out completely. The ligand stays on the cell membrane. Examples will be the Notch molecules, and that the ligand, the Notch family of ligand, Jagged or Notch, they actually stay on the cell membrane. So in order for the receptor to be able to bind to this ligand, the target cell that has the receptor has to come in really, really close with the signaling, the producing cells, so that the ligand and receptor can finally bind. So there are two cases where this happened a lot. One is the immune system. Your T cell receptors will respond to antigen that's in contact with the MHC molecules produced by the antigen-presenting cells. These two cells really have to contact each other for the signal transduction to happen. In development, like the Notch signaling, this happened a lot as well. So these two ensure the highest specificity. Only the cells have to contact each other. All the contacts has to be correct in order for signals to be propagated. So the affinity has to be very high, and the specificity is very, very good. But then, of course, the signal cannot go very far. So we need all sorts of signals in the body to fulfill different type of requirement that we need. Now, think about our cells. Our cells exist in our body that's constantly exposed to a lot of signals. The blood blood has all sorts of proteins and small molecules. You don't get one molecule that come in at any given time. At any given time, you get a combination of molecules. Some of the molecules tell the cells to do this, some molecules tell the cells to do that. So each cell has to interpret a combination of signals to decide what to do. And for example, a cell needs constantly three signals in order to just simply survive. If you take away these three signals, the cell will die in a way through what's called apoptotic cell death, so apoptosis. So the survival needs a certain signal transduction molecules, and we're going to talk about survival pathways. Now, if on top of these survival signal, you also give signal D and E to tell them to grow and divide, one cell then become two, you have proliferation. Okay. Now, if you change the signal combination, instead of D and E, you give F and G, that will tell the cell to differentiate into something else, to specialize into liver cells or into lung cells. And that specialization, again, depends on this combination signals. So every single moment, a cell needs to interpret a combination of signals. And that's, you know, you can have millions of combinations, you produce different outcomes. So it's a lot of it is a sort of a luck at that given moment, what cells is at what time, meet what molecules. And what we can do, this is a reality, but in a class, if I tell you, let's start five pathways at the same time, you're going to be dead. So we're studying one pathway at a time. But we're studying one pathway at a time, and then in the end, when you think about our cells, they're constantly interpreting five pathways at a time. If you think one pathway has 10 components, it's such a tedious thing to remember. The cells have to make decisions based on five, so don't lose this big picture when you proceed. Now, so it's not just the combination of signals. Sometimes, even given the same signals, the cell would interpret different ways, and that's the same thing in the human community. You hear the news, you know, Barack Obama says something, some people are happy to hear that, some people are not happy to hear that. And the same thing depends on what you have. It's that individual that received this. So the target cells also determine what type of response you get. The target cells can have slightly different receptors. For example, this is an example in response to acetylcholine, which is a neurotransmitter. In the heart muscle cells, you get one type of acetylcholine receptor, which leads to a decreased contraction or force of the cells, of these heart muscle cells, so it makes you calm down a little bit. But in the skeletal muscle cells, which is not, heart muscle is the smooth muscle cells, and skeletal muscle cells, in response to the same ligand, you get a different type of receptors. And this receptor actually allows the skeletal muscle cells to increase contraction, exactly opposite response from the heart muscle cells. And the reason is they have a slightly different receptor that combines to the same ligand. So you can have that variation. Now, think about another scenario where when we compare the heart muscle cells and salivary gland cells, which also have the exactly same receptor type as the heart muscle cells, but this is the salivary gland cells. The intracellular component of this cell is quite different from the heart muscle cells. That's why it's called heart muscle, and it's not a salivary gland. These cells have different intracellular signaling molecules, so that when in response to the same acetylcholine, instead of regulating the contraction of the cells, it actually increased secretion of the salivary gland, the saliva. So you see that the cells with the same receptor molecules but different downstream component can produce a very different outcome as well. So you can have all these variations happening in the same cell. Now, adding on this complexity with the previous complexity, you have different combinations of molecules. You can create an endless possibility for how cells respond to things. And in the final couple minutes, I'll just go review this nuclear receptor thing. As I said, this is the last time I'll mention this type of receptors, because from the next time on, we're going to focus exclusively on cell surface receptors. So this is an intracellular receptor. The inactive receptor is usually bound by an inhibitor protein complex, as shown here. So this green molecule is the receptor inside the cells. It has a transcription activating domain, meaning that this domain can activate gene expression. Next to this domain is a DNA binding domain. So these molecules are all transcription factors. They can all bind to DNA. So they have a DNA binding domain. Immediately next to the DNA binding domain, you get the ligand binding domain and the regulatory inhibitory protein binding domain. So without a steroid hormone, without the ligand, this little region is bound by an inhibitory protein, and that keeps the conformation of the DNA binding domain in such a way so that it doesn't have enough room for DNA to come in bind here. So it does not bind to DNA because the presence of this inhibitory protein, okay? And so that's what keeps this molecule inactive. When we say inactive, it's not referring to the ligand binding ability, it's referring to the transcription activation ability. It's inactive in DNA binding, it's inactive in transcription activation. Now, when you have a ligand, which is indicated in the red little ball, when you have a ligand that binds, the ligand binds to the ligand binding domain right here, and that causes a conformational change, which then dissociates the inhibitory proteins. So this part of the shape change, the inhibitory protein can no longer fit in the right pocket and get kicked away. So now the blue part then circle around the ligand binding domain, make it a much tighter binding inside. And that, you see, shift the direction of this molecule from going this direction to going up. And that fully exposed the DNA binding domain. Now this domain have enough room to really contact the big bulky DNA molecule, which is here. And now it can bind to DNA, and then when it's in that such a conformation, the transcription activation domain can then bind to the transcription coactivators, which bind to this part and this part at the same time. And these coactivators can then modify histones, and then that loosen up the nucleosomes and allow DNA transcription to happen. So you get mRNA transcription, you get a whole set of genes that's activated. So we call this receptor in the active conformation because it binds to ligand, it allows it to bind to DNA and transcription coactivators. So that's essentially what ligand does in the family of steroid hormones. The location of this molecule varies, as I said. Some of the steroid hormone receptors, like estrogen receptors, are in the cytosol. After ligand binding, this whole thing is now allowed to move into the nucleus, perhaps with the help of transport machineries, where it can now have access to DNA. Before that, the molecule cannot even touch DNA because it's in the cytosol. But in retinoic acid families, the receptor is in the nucleus, but it cannot bind to DNA. And therefore, ligand simply changes conformation to have this access. So that's how the steroid hormone family transduce their signals. It's very straightforward. It involves a conformational change. And that's the end of that. And we're going to start from the next lecture. We're going to talk about binding of the ligand to the receptors. Okay.
My question.
Sure.